The Sage Center is a school for gifted students on Oak Traffic Way in Gladstone. Most of the kids stop by once a week or so.
We do CAD, like 3D printing, we do laser etching. Some of the people down there were sewing, woodworking, just the whole ordeal. We're trying to make a piece of our own through materials, and we're trying to make products down there.
That's Cruz. He is a sixth grader. But right now, he's learning computer programs that a professional design firm might use in his graphic design class.
We progress really fast in this class, and we try to make the most out of it while we're here.
This semester, he's mastered making GIFs and posters, you know, practical skills, like how to Photoshop Steve Carell's face onto a picture of Dumbledore. It's not just the subject matter that's advanced in these classes, it's how they teach it. Kids have to figure things out on a deeper level. Things like
how to overcome problems in technology, especially because maybe like glitches or something. And let's say my Mac was crashing the other day, you have to overcome that somehow. And I felt like going really in depth with this really helped me, you know, overcome those problems.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about how to educate gifted students, which might sound like a non-problem problem, like how to cope with being too beautiful or having too many friends. But there are real perils and pitfalls when it comes to educating that student who picks things up faster than the other kids in the room. Call 816-235-2888 with your stories about how gifted programs have gone right or wrong for you or your family. 816-235-2888. Let's start with an update on how things are changing in this whole arena. Carmen Hubbard with us from the Kansas City Public Schools. Hello.
Hello.
And Rita Barger is with us from the School of Education at UMKC. She's a specialist in gifted education. Hi, Rita.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
So can we just start with what we're even talking about when we talk about gifted students?
Yes, well, gifted students are students that have abilities above the norm. And for our program in the Kansas City Public Schools, we have a pullout program where we offer advanced projects rooted in five strands: communication, creative thinking, critical thinking, problem solving, research. And we give them an additional challenge outside of the general ed classroom.
When you say above the norm, what does that mean?
Sometimes there could be a mismatch between their age and intellectual ability. So they could be, for example, in kindergarten, but they can read on a fifth grade level. Or they may have mathematical abilities beyond their age and grade.
So it might be really specific to a particular subject area, like reading?
Absolutely, yes.
Rita, chime in here.
Well, I was going to say that the state of Missouri has a list of criteria that a district can use when they're doing their screening and planning for gifted programs. And different districts use different criteria. A common one, of course, is IQ. And in IQ can often be mixed up with learning disabilities, to where a student might appear to not be gifted, but it's because of the learning disability, not because of the intellectual.
So help parse this out for me. I mean, what is the difference between having an extraordinary ability and being, quote unquote, the norm?
Well, one criteria would be advanced thinking, like Carmen said. Creativity would be another one. I had a student once who I use brain teasers in my regular classroom, and he always gave me one correct answer and one creative answer. And that's not normal. That's above. And so it could be creativity. It could be a high IQ. It could be extreme advancement in a particular subject matter. And at the younger age, kids with an unusual sense of humor, or a huge vocabulary that you don't expect, just things that are faster or above what's normally experienced.
Mm-hmm. So when we say above, that seems almost, I mean, I could imagine people hearing that as a value judgment, and I don't think that's what we mean. Gifted does not equal better.
No. Typically, the first criteria would be to look at the top 5% in an IQ, and then look at other criteria after that.
And also, just to gifted students are, they come in all shapes, sizes. Okay, they're, you do have to look at the criteria, but you also have to be careful about bias. As Rita said, sometimes students may exhibit certain behaviors or characteristics, and someone might not think that they are gifted, but we have to...
What are you talking about exactly, like certain behaviors and characteristics?
Because sometimes there are students that have high abilities, but they're underachieving. So we have to use certain criteria to, quote, find them sometimes. And it doesn't, gifted doesn't mean that they're better. It just means that they think a different way.
So can you give me maybe an example of a student you've encountered, obviously not naming names or anything, but a student you've encountered and their story, just someone who, based on our sort of shared preconceptions about what a gifted student looks like, performs like in school, that maybe made it hard to identify that student as gifted, but then once you did, things really took off for them.
Absolutely. I have a great example. I had a student that was identified as dyslexic, and so he had lots of challenges writing and reading even. But working with him, he was able to create scientific inventions. He came up with lots of advanced scientific ideas, and he could sketch them out. He could draw them. He couldn't necessarily write out his thoughts because of, you know, the switching around of letters and numbers like that. But he had, his gift was in science, in science inventions more specifically.
And what happened once, I mean, once he was identified as gifted, did things change for him in his overall experience of school?
You know, he really looked forward to spending time, and because our program is a pull-out program, he really...
What does that mean, a pull-out program?
So we have up to 150 minutes a week where we pull the student from the general ed classroom and provide gifted services. So they're out of their classroom for 150 minutes a week.
I want to come back to this, but Rita, mm-hmm. there's something you wanted to chime in here.
I wanted to tell you another example, and I was teaching eighth grade mathematics, and I had a student who everybody said was all trouble. And when I went to look at his permanent file, he had a stack of referrals for behavior that was probably 3 inches thick. The amazing thing was there was no repeats. Every one of those misbehaviors was for something different. Now, if that doesn't give an example of a gifted student whose challenges are
Wait,
not
what
being,
did that tell you?
Well, it tells you that he wasn't getting anything out of his schooling, so he was applying his thinking abilities to how can I get in trouble?
Coming up with new ways to get in trouble.
Absolutely.
So like a behavior problem that is sort of indicative of some deeper thing maybe would look like there's a pattern to it.
That's true. And a lot of times teachers are reluctant to identify somebody as gifted because the student causes some problems in class. And that does not necessarily mean that they're not gifted. In fact, it might be a reason that they are gifted.
So, but what would be the problem of letting gifted students just do what the rest of the kids do? I mean, I feel like you're kind of getting to it, but it doesn't, I think that at first glance, it might not sound like a problem to a lot of people.
Well, imagine having an ability that you're never able to further develop or cultivate. So if a gifted student isn't given that opportunity, they can stagnate in that gift. Okay, so just to go on the other end of the spectrum, if there is a student that has a great academic need, they're given the chance to, you know, grow or learn more or to cultivate that weakness. Gifted students should be given the opportunity to cultivate their strengths as well.
Rita, how has gifted education changed in the time you've spent working in this field?
Well, I would say that some of the problems remain. Some of the same things that we were discussing back in the 90s are still there.
Like what?
Well, like why do gifted students need extra support? Why can't they just get it on their own? Why don't we spend our time with the students who are struggling?
Where are those questions coming from?
They come from administrators. They come from parents. They come from the full population, the society. Somehow, giftedness in athletics or giftedness in music is not recognized as something that's a problem. It's something to be celebrated. Yet giftedness intellectually or creatively is seen as something that doesn't need to be nurtured.
Really? So talk to me more about that. That's just a general observation of our culture?
I think that it's almost like a elitism or a classism. And like
people think you're saying someone's better than someone else?
Yes. And we don't mind saying that when we're talking about athletics, for instance. But we do when we talk about education or just general learning.
And so that's something that's been consistent in the whole time you've been in this?
It really is. I would say that one of the characteristics of gifted students is that they make connections that other students don't see. And in math, I would have examples of an eighth grader who was talking about transcendental numbers. And I asked him, where'd you get that? And he said, well, I was reading a math book and it was in a footnote. So he had this interest, he had this passion, he had this hunger that needed to be met.
We were hearing from Carmen about pull-out programs where kids go into a separate program for some portion of their week, not for like full time. Is that a current trend that's got a lot of traction?
I would say so. I'd say that most of the districts have gifted programs for elementary, and then as you get older, the middle school and the high school, they tend to drop off. Districts feel like they serve the high school students by offering IB classes.
What is IB?
International Baccalaureate, or advanced placement AP classes, or dual credit classes with colleges. But they feel like they need to support the elementary students more. Now, pull-out programs are really almost the norm. The residential programs, and there is one for high school mathematics that's housed at Northwestern Missouri State. But in general, districts choose to either have a center where the students are brought to the center, like in Hickman Mills, it's one day a week, or they have a pull-out within the building, which is what Kansas City does.
But is the idea isn't that the classes themselves, you're doing like a higher level of that subject matter, it's that you're teaching it differently?
I would say it's both of those, that you're also doing a higher level and you're teaching it differently and you're using the students' direction in making decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then those core subjects, you're allowed to go deeper. So we might have some history buffs, and if they're learning something about American history, they have that hunger for something a little deeper in that core subject. So, yes, it's a combination of both.
Carmen, you actually went through a gifted program yourself, right?
I did.
Mm-hmm. When was this? Tell me the story of your experience from being identified as gifted to just how you moved through your classes and learned.
I was identified in the mid-80s, and I was in a self-contained gifted course classes.
How old were you?
I started in gifted in fourth grade. So fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, I had the opportunity to be in self-contained gifted classes. So I was with my gifted peers all day. And it was a great experience because I was with my peers. It wasn't any teasing for being different in that way. We were all the same. And
So socially, that was good.
Socially, it was amazing because, kids can be cruel. And, you know, back in the mid-80s, GT from General Ed stood for garbage and trash.
Oh, no.
Yes, we were teased. But once we got into our little safe bubble, it was, you could soar and be who you are.
Is there a social sort of stigma against gifted kids that you observe today?
You know,
in the Kansas City public schools?
Today, actually, because it's pull out, I see a lot of students that are not identified wanting to come because they think it's something cool. So in that
you're
way,
leaving school to do it,
and they assume that it's something that's really fun, which a lot of our students do. They really enjoy their time and pull out. So that's one difference I can see. It's in a lot of my schools, it's something cool or something that others want to participate in.
Something that I've had a question about is just when it comes to the social or developmental needs of these kids, do you think that separating kids who learn differently is a benefit, or do you think there is some advantage to having different abilities and learning styles all interacting with one another?
Well, with a pull-out program, or really all gifted programs, they still get to interact with general ed because they're in general ed for the majority of their school week. So, I know tracking is a dirty word in education right now, but to be around people where you can continue to advance and you're not the designated tutor or the mini teacher, you know, you get to go at your pace or to continue to advance. I think that is needed because I'll say again, gifted students should have the opportunity to develop and cultivate those gifts, those abilities.
Do you see that same thing that Rita was talking about, a sense that there's almost something that people shy away from and even acknowledging that some kids are so-called gifted in the intellectual arenas?
Yeah, there have been some people who don't want the E word, the elitism, I guess they don't want other students to feel like they are not on par.
That I would say that I can see the difference you're talking about in sports and music, but maybe in all of those arenas, I think is there some validity to that point that maybe when we try to say which students are gifted or not, that maybe we either miss something or give people a way of labeling themselves that lasts?
Well, one of the things that's a really good analogy for this is a three-legged stool. And so if you think intellectual, social, and emotional as the three legs of the stool, and if intellectually a student is more advanced, then that leg of the stool is longer. And so trying to sit on that stool is very difficult. And that's kind of the experience that gifted students have, is they want to be with everybody else. They want to be liked. And they have this long leg that's causing a balance problem. And so I think that the answer usually is not all of one thing or all of another thing. It's a combination, just like Carmen was saying, that they are mostly in general education classes, and then they have the opportunity to be in gifted.
Let's hear from some of our listeners. We have quite a few calls. Maria is calling us from Overland Park about her family's experience with gifted education programs. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Thank you so much. I think your guest today actually hit a lot of the frustrations and a lot of the things that I was just talking to the producer about. So I'm from the state of Kansas, and my kids both go to the public school district. And my experience, again, like we were talking, has been very different. With my child, like your guest said, the issue ended up being that he was bored to death in class, and he would become disruptive. And first grade was so difficult because the teacher was constantly like emailing and texting me, he did this, he did that. First and foremost, I'm an educator myself, so I didn't understand why am I constantly being notified about this. And so I went up and I was like, you know, these are the books that he's reading, this is what he's writing, I think he's bored. And they're like, oh, no, we think your child has ADHD. And so I'm in the medical field, and I kind of knew that that's not what he had, but you know, I was like, it could be, I don't want to diagnose and treat my own child. So I actually went and had him evaluated, and they were like, no, this is not it, but we do think you need to get him tested on your own, because he might be bored in class because he's doing way beyond what is expected of this age. So I had to end up, you know, $550 out. I actually found a psychologist that basically specialized in gifted kids and identifying and everything. And lo and behold, my son was in there for like the first 20 minutes, and she comes out and she's like, I still have to go through the entire test because it's a state requirement. But
Maria, this sounds like quite an ordeal, and thank you for sharing it. I want to turn to Rita here about, first of all, my first question about this is, are a lot of kids being diagnosed with things based on being bored in class?
I think that that probably is true. Now, I don't have research knowledge that can back that up, but I do think that one of the things that happens is trying to pigeonhole kids, and I know that parents are really a resource to keep that from happening.
And then there's this other question about, she's saying that she's calling from Kansas and that it sounds to her like things are different. Are there major differences between the two states in their policies on gifted education?
Yes. The big difference is whether gifted education is considered special education or not. In Missouri, gifted education is separate. In Kansas, gifted education is a part of special education, and special education
has... So gifted is a form of a special need.
Exactly. And that means that it has to follow all of the federal and state guidelines for disabilities, which include an IEP, an Individualized Educational Plan, and a lot of legislative rules that you have to go through before you could get a student into a gifted program.
Wow. Let's talk to Lindsay in St. Joe. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey. Hey, I had a kind of similar journey into the gifted program when I was in the mid-80s. In fourth grade, I started, and it was a program where we were pulled out one day a week and bused to a different school. Unfortunately, the program that I was in was very heavily science and project oriented, where the students themselves had to pay and have a lot of resources in order to succeed. And
pay for what? Can you explain that a little more?
We did lots of science projects where you had to come up with your own hypothesis, do the testing, and then present it. And back then, we didn't have PowerPoint. We had to do the boards, and you bring your materials in. And so, me being from definitely the poorest school in the district, my parents did not have the resources for any of that. And so, I was doing projects that I could pull out of my toy box or, you know, things in my yard. And it was just well below what I could have done. But since the school itself didn't provide any of those things, I dropped out. I was embarrassed at what I was doing, and I quit.
Lindsay, I'm so sorry to hear that story.
Yeah, well, you know, it was 30-ish years ago, so I'm cool with it now. But I just wondered what Missouri, if it's the same type of project-based education that your guests are doing.
Well, first, let me say it depends on district to district. Every district is different, but some of our project, we do have some project-based activities. It just really depends on what our focus for the year is, because we do some long-term planning. It can be project-based.
So, okay. My big question, based on what we heard from Lindsay, is how do you prevent kids from, you know, like with different classes, different races? Do kids sometimes get left behind based on these kinds of distinctions, these demographics?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because first of all, some of those things may factor into the nomination process, which is very unfortunate.
But how does that happen?
For example, there may be characteristics or whatever for a teacher not to nominate a student. But clearly there could be some evidence of a need to test to see if that student could qualify for services. In our population, we have a lot of students where English is not their first language. So they may feel that because they're struggling with English, that it might not be beneficial to be pulled out of class.
So last question here. I mean, we have a caller who I don't have time to go to right now, but he says that he didn't have these kinds of classes available to him and felt that he was shortchanged when it was time to apply for colleges and that it made him less competitive. Is the college application process, does that loom large over this subject of gifted education?
I think one of the things that gifted programs help students in, if they have high school students, is in the college application process. But I would also say that the students that don't have access to the gifted programs also then don't have all of the things that they can put on a resume that would attract interest from especially the private colleges and the very expensive colleges.
Rita Barger with us from UMKC. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Gina.
And Carmen Hubbard, thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
Carmen teaches gifted education in the Kansas City Public Schools, and she is a graduate of the system she teaches in. Up next, how to grill everything with Mark Bittman. If you have a question for him, grilling or otherwise, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we've got Mark Bittman on the line. Yes, the Mark Bittman of How to Cook Everything, the pantheon of cookbooks that's given so many people command of their kitchens. Now he's got a new book, How to Grill Everything, and he's coming to Kansas City through Rainy Day Books next week. You can call him with your grilling stories and grilling questions, grilling snafus and strokes of genius at 816-235-2888. Mark Bittman, good morning.
Hi there, Gina. Nice to talk with you again.
Nice to talk with you, too. I might have actually been drooling while I was reading your book.
and you know what? It's funny about books because they go away and come back to you. You work on them and then other people work on them, editing and indexing and taking pictures and so on. And then they come back. And this one really makes me hungry, too. I was looking at it at 7:30 this morning getting ready for a TV spot. And I was like, yeah, I want to make that. So that's a good sign.
Yeah. What inspired you to take on the grill in particular?
You know, I started grilling when I started cooking, which was over 40 years ago, 45 years ago. But I grew up in Manhattan and there were no grills.
No backyards, really,
to speak of. And we used to go to Long Island once a month or so to visit cousins, and they would grill hamburgers and hot dogs. There was literally nothing else that anyone ever grilled then. But still,
and
that
those
was
are
exotic.
Still pretty popular.
Yeah, for sure. But at that time, to me, this was like the most exotic thing imaginable. So when I started cooking, grilling was, you know, something that I had never really had access to. And as soon as I was able to get a grill, I did. And I really loved it. So I've been taking notes on grilling and learning about grilling for 40 plus years. And I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, it just seemed like it was time to sort of codify some of this. And I took my time, and I'm really pleased with the results.
There's a certain kind of relationship people have with their kitchens, and I feel like there's also a very specific kind of relationship people have with their grills. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, people are very, you know, I've long taken the unpopular position that gas grills are okay. Even, you know, and it's unpopular despite the fact that the majority of grills in the United States at this point are gas grills. But people who are serious about grilling or consider themselves serious about grilling are usually big advocates of lump charcoal or even of wood fires, you know, raw wood fires. And
caveman style.
That is the best. I mean, there's no question. It's the best. But so if you have an hour and a half, you can do a wood fire. And if you have an hour, 45 minutes, you can do a charcoal fire. But if you have 15 minutes, you do a gas fire, and it works pretty well. So, you know, I'm all in favor of being obsessive if that's who you are. And I, you know, I love people who take cooking very seriously and are adamant about the way they do things. But I think, you know, one of the problems with cooking in the United States is that a lot of people are intimidated by it, and not enough people do it. And my job is really to make things seem simpler, like less obsessiveness is needed, less compulsion, even less knowledge. And, you know, for those people, I really try to, you know, I don't want to say dumb it down, but just make it as easy as possible. And when it comes to grilling, that means gas.
Well, you know, I want to get back to that, but you do have a really distinctive way of simplifying and demystifying the cooking process without using, I mean, no cheap tricks or really shortcuts, but just, I don't know, purity is a loaded term, but there is this idea that I feel like you boil it down to what's essential in a dish and kind of skim off the showing off part of cooking.
So you're saying like the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. I'm not sure what you want me to. Thank
well,
you.
I wonder how.
Yes, I try.
How you developed that eye for what is essential, and what is just sort of.
Yeah, I can answer that. I know what you're. I mean, I was kind of kidding, but it was very nice of you. So thanks.
You're welcome.
I think it's two things. I think one is I was a journalist before I wrote about food, and I was a print journalist. Remember that? And at a time when. I was actually a print journalist at a time when cutting and pasting meant scissors and paste. So, you know, if someone said we can use 650 words or 800 words or 912 words, that was pretty much what you had to do. So I learned how to write on deadline and I learned how to write concisely. So I think that's part of it. But I think more important is that I was a working journalist with two young kids and a partner who worked out of the house, and cooking was sort of not only my passion but my job. And I often had to cook on deadline too, so I learned how to cut corners, and I think I learned pretty quickly which corners could be cut without affecting the result too badly. So I just would look at a number of recipes and think, okay, I know that this is supposed to take an hour, but I have 40 minutes. What am I going to do? And that was kind of my early style, and that has always stuck with me. I have more time now.
Oh man!
Course, but, yeah.
But you are giving me hope. I'm having mixed results in pretty similar experiments.
Well, you have the benefit of my cookbook, so
I,
you know.
Well, so speaking of which, one of my favorite recipes of yours is an apple pizza. It's this very rustic apple pie without any of that weird goo.
Right. We call it a crust. I mean, it's called a crostata. I mean, it basically is pizza dough, although you can make a richer dough than that if you want to, and baked with sweet instead of savory toppings, apple with cinnamon, sugar, etc., and in a pretty much as hot an oven as you can manage. And yeah, that's one of my favorites too, because that's like a no-brainer, really simple dessert. It's not like you're making pastry creams and layer cakes and so on. You're making a quick dough with an incredibly simple topping. So,
and you can really taste the apples.
Yep.
What are your favorite, like, go-to recipes that, of your own recipes, that you keep going back to again and again? Do you do that?
It's not like, I don't want to say that I start from scratch every time, but I don't use my own recipes except to make sure that they work. And then after that, it's kind of like I open the refrigerator, I see what's there, and my mind goes to work. And, you know, I've since learned, I've been doing things that way for probably half my cooking career, that, you know, since learned that that's kind of a stage of cooking that people get to after cooking hundreds or thousands of times. And that's, you know, that's kind of where chefs are at, which is to say, it's not so much testing things to see if they work. It's imagining things and knowing that they'll work. It doesn't mean that some adjustments aren't necessary from time to time. But if I open the refrigerator and I see five or six or eight things that are appealing and I can imagine a way to put them together in one or two dishes that sounds good, that's dinner.
Well, Mark Bittman, you know, I feel like you're getting at when you talk about that there's this stage of cooking where you imagine it and you know it'll work. That is one of the things your approach to recipes does, is it empowers cooks to understand why they're doing what they're doing, and then to also understand the freedom they have to play with the details. I wonder if there is a if there is a readership that finds that frustrating, that you're not just telling them what to do?
I know there is, because among that readership is one of my close friends who says, can't you just give me the damn recipe? And it's not my style. I mean, I can give you the recipe, but I think that the variation, the value is really in learning how to tweak the recipe. And my interest and my desire is to show people that once you've mastered, I don't know, roast chicken with rosemary, then mastering roast chicken with thyme and garlic and root vegetables is like not a whole new thing, but just a kind of tweak.
So let's get back to grilling, since your new book is How to Grill Everything. In the introduction, you write, cooking is the same whether you do it on a range or a grill. That is, the same skills apply. You control the heat, tune into your senses, and learn to recognize doneness. The idea of being attuned to your senses and recognize doneness does seem like sort of that critical, like, almost athleticism of the grill master.
It's kind of a Jedi thing to people who don't get it. Well, all I can say is that it isn't magic. It's just experience. It's not talent. It's just practice. I don't think anyone's born with it, and I think anyone can learn it, but you can only learn it through repetition. So, and I have to say, this is going to make, I think, a lot of people, probably yourself included, feel good. I still panic all the time. I mean, I still get that, oh, I'm so obviously undercooking this or overcooking it. And yet, and I've been grilling a lot recently, not only because the book is making me want to grill, but because the weather's turned better. And I still take an unfamiliar piece of meat or a whole fish or something I haven't done in a while and put it on the grill and think, well, I have really no clue what I'm doing here. And yet, at some point, your experience takes over and you think, yeah, this looks to be just about right, and you feel it and you smell it, and it is. I mean, it's not mystical. It's, as I said, it's just experience and practice. It doesn't mean that you're totally confident that you're doing it right, but most times you are.
Well, Mark Bittman, hang on with me. I'm Gina Kaufman. Mark Bittman's new book is How to Grill Everything. We'll take your calls in just a minute at 816-235-2888. And we will hear how he grills yogurt, polenta squares, meat too, but all, like, everything is for real. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm chatting with Mark Bittman, whose new book is How to Grill Everything. You can call us up with your grilling triumphs, snafus, and strokes of genius at 816-235-2888. And Mark, you know, about a year ago on this show, we had a local guy on talking about how he had drunkenly discovered how to grill eggs.
Mm.
Is this something that that you have tips on?
Well, I mean, I would have tips on them, but I think our time is better spent talking about less esoteric things. I mean, let's say this, one of the points of How to Grill Everything, which, you know, you haven't mentioned this, so I will. It's big. It's 250 recipes and 750 variations or thereabout, and with photos, and fabulous in all ways. But now that that's done, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that there are three or four aspects of it that I'm quite proud of. And, you know, one of them is that it's really appeal to beginners. And I think we've touched on that. But the others are that I tackle vegetables, which a lot of people find challenging to imagine grilling. And I tackle breads and desserts, which are even more unusual.
And cheese and yogurt.
Yeah, and some
yogurt, I think, is
like
the height.
Well, the yogurt is smoked, but I mean, you know, you can smoke water. You can add smoke flavor to anything that you want to. It's not grilled yogurt in the sense that it's somehow magically turning a liquid into a solid. But grilled cheese, that's cheese without bread, that's just grilled, that's a kind of unusual thing. But I, you know, the the grilled strawberries and the grilled apple crisps and the grilled biscuits and stuff are I'm especially proud of. And as I said, the grilled vegetables.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very meat-centric town. You probably know that. We are famous for barbecue. So this idea of grilling, yeah, like you're saying, strawberries, Brussels sprouts, polenta squares, for a grilling town, this is, I would say, a pretty foreign concept.
I get that. You know, I think of, I don't want to get to, again, I don't want to get too esoteric, but there's a big difference between barbecue and grilling. And we're, you know, those of us who know Kansas City a little bit love Kansas City barbecue. And, you know, it's the world's best and all of that. But grilling is a simpler, more straightforward thing. And barbecue is maybe a subset of grilling, but grilling is not a subset of barbecue. Grilling is really, at the end of the day, cooking over live or cooking over fire, cooking with an exposed flame. That means, I mean, anything is fair game for that. That's just the way everybody cooked until X years ago, only some number of hundred years ago. And there's nothing you can't do. It doesn't mean that it, you know, that you want to like turn on the grill in order to cook eggs, for example, or yogurt.
Our guest did say it was very good.
I'm sure it's good. But I would say it's the kind of thing you do. And I would say this about the desserts and How to Grill Everything also. It's the kind of thing that you do incidentally or coincidentally. That is to say, the grill is on. What should I be doing now that I'm grilling? And there's, once you ask yourself that question, the answers are myriad. There are a zillion things you can do once you get started.
The cheese thing, I will get to meat, I promise.
That's all right. I don't mind. You know.
The cheese thing has like a whole history behind it. I mean, you write about provoleta, which is a grilled cheese dish from Argentina. So even though we're talking about this like it's esoteric, it's not esoteric everywhere.
Well, this is the thing about cooking, is that you think you've invented something or you think you've imagined something new, but it turns out someone halfway around the world has been doing it forever. I mean, which is okay. I mean, learning from other cultures is part of life and certainly part of cooking. So, yeah, there's nothing new under the sun, that's for sure.
So another dish that definitely caught my interest was in the veggie category, quick pickled charred vegetables.
You know, you and everybody else.
Really?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And you know, you can pickle a cucumber, for example, in 20 minutes. You cut it open and pour some salt on it and let it sit in a colander, and you basically have the most elemental kind of pickle. But if you char things before pickling them, then when you do pickle them, they just have a denser, richer, obviously more charred flavor. And that, that recipe's sort of caught everybody's eye. It's interesting.
It could be partially the photos, I guess. You know, okay, so
I'll have to look at those.
you do go into the gas versus charcoal debate, which we've talked a little bit about. And also you talk about, in sort of a tools of the trade sense as well, woods for smoking.
Well, I'm really intrigued by the gas versus charcoal debate, as you can tell. And I think one reason is because I do believe that a heat source is a heat source. And another reason is that we all cook on gas stoves. And people often say to me, oh, how could you possibly cook on an electric stove once you've cooked on gas? In the same way that people say, how can you cook on a gas grill when wood and charcoal grills exist? But this is my one practical bit of advice for the day, which is that if you take a gas grill and you walk around your backyard and you gather some sticks and you put them on part of that gas grill, you have just built, or you will have built, a wood fire. And since you're probably cooking with the top of the grill down anyway, you now have a smoky wood fire on a gas grill. And the flavor you get out of that, if not identical to that of a wood fire, is really, really close. So I'm hoping to kind of end this debate during the course of this book tour.
Well, one of the sort of through lines of the recipes in this book, How to Grill Everything, is that you use visual cues more than absolute times, which makes sense because different grills are going to be different. Can you talk about some of the idea of the sensory experience of being at the grill? I think is a really powerful one. I think it's a big part of why people do it. And I'm curious about one of your favorite like visual moments where you see something transform in that heat and you know it's ready.
You know, it's a good question. And I think there is, of course, grilling, barbecuing, most notably smoking, of course, that takes place over hours and hours. But a lot of grilling is pretty quick stuff. And I do remember some times when I discovered that some things are actually better grilled over low heat than over high heat, which is not obvious to beginners. Everybody thinks when you're grilling something, you're kind of blasting it.
You want those char lines.
And you do, but those can happen slowly as well as quickly. And things like sliced vegetables or vegetables in many forms are better cooked slowly. And for the most part, chicken, you know, especially with chicken with the skin on, is better cooked slowly than quickly also. And I think, you know, what you look for in these cases, I mean, with vegetables, what you look for mostly is kind of tenderness, which you can see with your eye. You can certainly see.
How do you see tenderness in a vegetable?
Well, I mean, it looks done. And if that doesn't work for you, then you take a sharp small knife and you stick it in there and you feel whether it's tender or not. And the same, you know, that can be true of a whole head of broccoli as well as it can be true of a thin slice of eggplant. You can see it, and until you learn how to see it, you can certainly feel it. So yeah, I mean, this is true of most of cooking. Timing is approximate because everybody's notion of medium heat is different. So, and everybody's stove is different, everybody's grill is different, everybody's equipment is different. You have to learn, you know, eventually you have to learn how to cook by sight and touch and smell and taste, as opposed to by time, because time is really the most approximate measurement.
Okay, Mark Bittman, this is a book about grilling, and I will admit that my great strength as a cook is not meat. And so I do like to eat meat, but I'm not great at working with it. So I'm going to let you pick the most fascinating meat recipe in your How to Grill Everything book, because I know that that's probably what a lot of our listeners want to hear about.
Okay, but you're going to have to give me a second because like I don't memorize
literally thumbing through
favorites. No, because, you know, I like a lot of different things. And as I said, I cook what's in front of me most of the time. But okay, having said that, and because I think we're running out of time too, I really love and always have loved butterflied leg of lamb because when you butterfly a leg of lamb, you get different thicknesses of meat. And lamb is actually good at every stage from rare to well done. And that sort of happens kind of automatically when you butterfly a leg of lamb. So I'm going to pick butterflied leg of lamb, shawarma style. Page 316. Check that out.
What's your favorite thing about preparing that dish?
That it makes everybody happy when they're eating it.
Aw. Mark Bittman, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Gina.
Mark Bittman's new book is How to Grill Everything. He'll be in town for a conversation called Food for Thought on May 23rd. At 7 p.m. That event takes place at Unity Temple on the Plaza, and for more information, you can visit rainydaybooks.com. And that's a wrap. Listen to any of our past shows, including this one, at kcur.org/centralstandard. If you missed our conversation earlier in the hour, we talked about trends and gifted programs in the schools. Be sure and grab that when you get a chance. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, can you see your own history in the old t-shirts in your closet? A t-shirt exhibit has us wondering what these relics say about us and why we have a hard time letting them go. Share your t-shirt story tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross, Coy Duggar, Jen Chen, and intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.